Jackson County prosecutor Jean Peters Baker is known for taking on tough cases. I'm just going to tell you about one of them now. We'll hear about plenty of others in the course of the next hour. The case I want to talk about is one that really haunts me, and it probably haunts some of you. It's the case of Deja Bosby. Deja was a star student at her high school. She was a rule follower and a go-getter. But a couple of months before graduation, she was found dead in a Kansas City motel room. Her classmates and teachers found it nearly impossible to believe that Deja would have been up to something shady to land her in that hotel room. That just wasn't the Deja they knew, and a lot of signs pointed to the possibility that this might have something to do with Deja's dad. This all happened in 2016. Over the next several months, DNA testing and an examination of Deja's body provided enough evidence against Jerry Bosby that charges were filed against him for the sexual assault and murder of his own daughter. A part of me, and I'm sure a part of you, would like to be done with this story right here and now, and that's what brings me back to Jean Peters Baker. When a story sounds kind of like this one, she gets to work, and this past June, when Jerry Bosby took the stand, Jean Peters Baker had to explain in gruesome detail how she knew from a physiological standpoint that Deja had fought back. She held up a picture of the teen in that motel room, and her voice shook as she told the jury, "This is not consent." Jerry Bosby was found guilty on July 15th of this year. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And one day before his sentencing, we're going to sit down with Jean Peters Baker to hear what this work is about for her. Jean Peters Baker, good morning.
Good morning.
How do you understand your role in the personal story of Deja Bosby and in the stories of other victims like her?
You know, I have such a great opportunity. The job that I have is really, I've been doing it for a long time now, you know, over 20 years, but it still remains a real privilege to be able to represent the voice of Deja Bosby when her voice was silenced.
This is not for the faint of heart what you do.
No, it is certainly not. As my husband has reminded me many times over the years when my dining room table serves as the layout for exhibits for trials. it's not for public consumption, even, you know, as my family might walk by and take a look at what might be on the dining room table. So,
a lot of people would not want their kids to hear the story I just told about the murder and assault of Deja Bosby. You, I understand, brought your teenage son to the courtroom for that trial.
I did. The facts of that case were so horrible that I actually used my 16-year-old son to serve as a sounding board for how to give an opening statement, you know, what to say. And he was actually very helpful. And because he was so helpful, it was his choice to come and watch the trial. But I knew it was an important case for him to see because his life is so very, very, very different than Deja's. And I wanted him to see his position in the world as opposed to hers.
Did he? Do you think that that's what he came away with?
I think absolutely. Yeah, I think he did. So, you know, he too wants, he's 16, but he wants to do this kind of work someday. So when he can sit through that kind of evidence and hear it and think that's what he still wants to do, then I'm all for it. I hope he does.
Can you give a quick basic job description for what a county prosecutor does, just for those who might have more of like a vague understanding of what it is you do?
You know, I will tell you, I miss the days of being an assistant prosecutor.
Being an assistant has its perks.
It sure does. And I miss it because you really get to dig into and specialize in one area of the law. For instance, I worked in sex crimes and child abuse for a handful of years as an assistant, and you get good at that, and you understand the law better than anybody else.
When it comes to that specific area of the law.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
Then the county prosecutor, you don't have that luxury of specializing?
No, you don't. You really don't because the county prosecutor must be, really adept at budget and HR, personnel matters, recruitment, big picture policy ideas, not just for your area and your region, but nationally. Folks like us should be a voice for what's on the horizon. What should we be looking for? What should we be thinking about? So it's all of those things, but it's also running a good day-to-day operation, making sure that the public can trust that you're doing your job well and their tax dollars are being used wisely and efficiently and the best way we can do it.
So how do you do that work? I know that is a gigantic question and it has got to vary from one day to the next, one issue to the next, but you deal with specific cases like the one we just heard about. You also deal with citywide issues like gun violence, mm-hmm. for example, more broadly. And I'm curious to hear about the tools in your toolkit, like how much of the job is legal expertise, how much is the nitty-gritty of case building, how much is politics, how much management, communication, community engagement. There's probably even other stuff I'm not even thinking of right now.
It's all of those things. And on any given day, you may have to sharpen one particular area over another. HR is not, I did not go into HR. I don't love HR, but you have to be good at HR and you have to know where to go to get some, professional guidance on that issue. And if you're not good at HR, you're not going to be good at a whole lot of other things within your office. So
because you need the whole team.
You need the whole team, right? And so you have to be a little bit of a jack of all trades. And I'm sure there's lots of people who, have similar responsibilities that have that same experience that, oh, boy, I didn't know I was going to spend, 25% of my week on HR matters, but that's what you do because that's what's needed.
You've been Jackson County prosecutor for, you just said, a little over 20 years. Is that right?
I have been an assistant prosecutor.
Okay. You've been in the office that long.
Yeah, that long.
How long have you been the Jackson County prosecutor?
Since 2011.
And what would you say are some of the most significant changes or developments you've seen in Kansas City overall over that time?
Over that time, there's definitely been an increase in the number of guns that I think police have to encounter, everyday citizens encounter. There's a more of a cavalier attitude as well about carrying a gun. Once upon a time, it was viewed much more seriously that if you were going to carry, you were very thoughtful about that. There was more planning, there was more training, all of those things. And there's a lot more factors, I think, that we all thought about. And I think there's a bit of a bravado in the air and in the dialogue about guns and how much safer they'll all make us, and about just the general notion, that we're a gun-carrying nation. And so that has sort of expanded, I think, what police officers have to encounter and how they encounter people has to be quite different than it was even just a handful of years ago.
What's your personal experience with that topic?
My personal experience really has a very wide range because I grew up on a farm and my dad sent me to hunter safety school when I was 12. So my experiences are really broad ranging. But I know that gun laws in Missouri are made for that little farming community where I was born and raised, not for the streets of Kansas City. So Kansas City just has to sort of adapt. And we're having a hard time doing that.
What do you see as the biggest problem we face as a city right now from the vantage point of county prosecutor?
I don't know that I can point to one singular issue as being the issue and that if we could just solve that one problem, there we'd be, all would be well. And I will even say that about guns. While guns, I think, are a very important factor in our deregulation of guns in the state of Missouri is an important factor to consider. It's simply that a factor rather than the only factor. There's a degree of hopelessness that certain communities of kids feel, and that's their life, you know, starting off feeling hopeless, you know, rather than my 16-year-old son, you know, that he wants to go, you know, he at 16, he's planning, you know, his life to go to law school and all the things that he might do with that. And that may not occur for him. He may change his path.
But he sees a bright future.
He sees a bright future for himself. And so it pains me that his view is so very, very different from kids that live just blocks away from where he lives. And that bothers me.
Yeah. And I mean, I have noticed that you often invoke the responsibility of the entire community when it comes to justice, particularly for children. And I'm interested in that perspective, this idea that you seem to, when speaking publicly, often remind people that they have a responsibility no matter where they live within the city, no matter what their personal relationship to violent crime is within the city, that they still, that these children are like our collective responsibility.
Yeah. You know, look, kids, kids represent such innocence and such hope, you know, and they are how we treat our kids and how we are preparing them for the future is what it's what we all need to expect for our future. If we're not preparing them, we're not fully protecting them, then, you know, it's not going to be a very bright future for us either.
Something you once said in one of these conversations actually changed my behavior. I asked you on this show what the average Kansas Cityan can do to curb violence and protect innocent children. And one of the things you mentioned was that we should always call the police when we hear gunshots, which sounds so simple. But before you said that, I would sometimes hear gunshots in the night. They would wake me up and I would feel really disturbed, but since I didn't know what direction they were coming from or how far away the sound was, I thought I didn't have enough information to be useful. Mm-hmm. You corrected me on that, and now I always get up and call the police. It seems like these are conversations you are always having with people.
Yeah, that's a simple thing that people can do. It's important for police. You know, police need to have as many tools as they can to do their jobs. And to do it well. And so a community that works with police and police works with community is what we should all be seeking, you know, how we can better improve those relationships.
What's changed you and your behavior in the time that you've been Jackson County prosecutor?
Well, believe it or not, I'm more measured. I mean, I got some rules for today. You know, there's no cussing. So I'm pretty sure I can adhere to that rule. So I have, maybe it's just time, maybe it's age, have become a bit more measured.
I would also think that, like, even as someone who just works in news, when I hear a story that reminds me of what some people face as genuine, real problems, that day I usually go home not seeing my own problems in quite the same light.
Yeah, isn't that the truth? You know, one of the crime can be one of those great equalizers as well, right? That it can strike anyone at any time. And when it strikes you or strikes your family, it's not forgotten. It's not something that, you know, you can completely repair from and move on. And you know, we all know that from moms who have to learn, they celebrate new anniversaries, and that's the anniversary that their kid died. And I think the way I view this job is from someone with very grateful eyes, that I'm grateful that there, but before the grace of God go I, that it's simply not the choice some moms get. They get what they get. And when violence hits your family, it leaves an indelible mark.
We'll get back to you and your current job, but I want to know more about your past and what brought you to this role. You've mentioned this just in passing, but where did you grow up? Describe the community.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a place that some folks might find a little weird, but it wasn't weird. It was home, and it's a little town called Frankenstein, Missouri. I'm actually very proud of it. I'm proud of that place. I'm proud of the people that are there and what I learned growing up on a farm.
What did you learn growing up on a farm?
To be resourceful. You know, when you grow up in a farming community, especially you grow up, you know, away from a town, even, you know, a small town, you have to be resourceful because your trash doesn't get picked up. And because the gravel road you live on doesn't get plowed. So if you want to go somewhere, you know, you do it yourself. If you need to figure out how to take care of your own trash, it just makes you be more resourceful.
And you've talked about going hunting with your dad. Can you tell me more about what that represents in your relationship with him?
Yeah. You know, I can't say I was this avid hunter. My dad was. And so we did what my dad wanted to do. And so I guess the way I would explain this to listeners is that I was my dad's third daughter, and he was sort of out of resources at that point in time. So I became the token boy for my dad. I was his hunting buddy, and, you know, so I went deer hunting a lot with my dad.
I wonder, I mean, if this is a piece of your upbringing that might have prepared you for a career where you're a woman in a male-dominated field.
I think in a way my dad prepared me for that. In an odd way, my dad was not a feminist, by the way. it's funny to me to hear my dad and feminist in the same sentence, because that would be weird. But my dad
Can
was...
Can you talk more about that?
You know, it was just a different era, a different time. And, you know, my dad had certain notions about women and what their role was. And I strongly disagreed with him. But my dad showed me some glimmers that he didn't wholly, you know, get wholesale by that theory.
There were some, like, things that he said or did that didn't quite fit with that worldview.
Yeah, there were glimmers. My dad would really challenge me. And when I'd want to join, you know, the boys' baseball team, you know, my dad would, in an odd way, encourage that. You know, my dad really encouraged a sense of competition in me. And that's... You know, I want it to please my dad. And so I did what kids do. You know, I tried to compete.
What is your relationship with that place where you grew up now at this stage in your life? Is it a place that you go back and visit a lot? Do you think about it a lot in your work or in your own life?
I think, you know, one of the things it taught me is that people are just people. So we all have different experiences. And so your worldview sometimes is based on what's around you, where you came from, what you saw. And so the more people, you know, you can meet and bring into the fold, I think it's important. It's very important for politics that you have a better understanding of people and places. And so that's the biggest piece I learned, is that there are good people on every block in America and every town in America.
What was your school like?
My school, now, this is where I guess things get a little weird. My school was four rooms for grades 1 through 8. And that meant one teacher, a Catholic nun, taught two grades simultaneously in the same room. And I got a great education.
You know, the county where you now work in criminal justice looks very different from the place where you grew up, it sounds like, with that caveat that people are people, you know. But can you talk about that a little? Because I can imagine it being very surprising to someone someone like you, who looks squarely in the face of urban violence and all the complex history behind it, seemingly without flinching, is from a small rural town and grew up in the tough but still in some ways kind of idyllic setting you describe?
Oh, it was not idyllic. It was a tough life. And that's in no way to make comparisons to what it's like living poor in an urban core neighborhood. There's no comparisons. But where I grew up, it was not idyllic. It was hard. And, you know, my dad had to leave the family farm and drive 1 hour to a job as a manufacturer to make enough money to support the family and come back home after a long day and farm. That's how we did it. So, you know, it wasn't so idyllic.
Yeah.
Growing up on a farm means there's never a vacation and there's never a day off. That's just par for the course. It's what you sign up for in farming. So, to grow up, you know, kind of with all the outdoors around you, I miss that a great deal. I miss being, you know, being outside more and just being in nature and kind of having that ownership of land.
We have to take a break. When we come back to the story of Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker, we'll hear how she got her start in public service by attending night school and how Claire McCaskill served as a mentor back when she was county prosecutor. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR's Central Standard. Will resume in a minute. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're in the middle of a portrait session with Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters Baker. You can tweet us your questions for her. We're at KCURCST, and I'll try to get to as many of those as I can. We just heard about Jean Peters Baker's upbringing on a farm in Osage County, Missouri. And Jean, I want to talk now about your early career, which was not in law. It was in art and graphic design.
Yeah. Yeah. Someday, you know, maybe I'll go back to art. That was a pretty wonderful time of life too.
How did you get into public service and law? What inspired you to switch gears so dramatically?
They're not that different in my mind. Art and law are both creative. You have to, you know, law is black letter. But you have to look at it and see what you might be able to make of it. Can you make a charge work based on the facts that you have? So it can be creative, just not quite in the same way.
It is interesting to me to think about that you were working a day job as a graphic designer when you started taking the night classes that really got you interested in public service.
Absolutely. Yeah, that... I kind of caught the fever, you know, the bug of problem solving. And so I was in a master's program where it was in the Columbia, Missouri area. Some of my classes were actually in Jefferson City to accommodate state workers who were heads of departments. And so I got to see how they were trying to solve problems and also advance their education. And I kind of I caught the bug.
Do you remember someone who you got to sort of get to know who was working in Jeff City and talking about what they did and what they were trying to figure out that just got your mind turning?
You know, it wasn't a singular person. There were several people that came in and went through that program while I was in it as well. And they were impressive individuals that were responsible for budget for the state of Missouri. Individuals that led education for the state of Missouri. And they were really, really trying to do the best job they knew how to do and advance their own subject matter expertise so they could be even better
at
their job.
How had you thought about politics before that?
Oh, yes. I had thought about politics before that because I was around it during college, I was a tour guide in the Capitol building, and so I was surrounded by politicians and got to see all kinds of politicians during that era. So, you know, you can't help but think about it because it was all around me.
But did your perspective change when you got to know people as classmates?
So, the folks that I was actually in that master's program with were individuals that were, they were not technically politicians.
Okay.
They worked for politicians, perhaps, and they were just trying to do the best job they knew how to do for the state of Missouri. The politicians were the elected officials in the Capitol building in an era when, you know, there was a lot of alcohol brought into that building. It looked at times more like a frat party than it looked like state government.
So you were inspired by the staffers.
Oh, yes. Right. By the staffers. Now, there were some politicians that I thought really did a great job and that were impressive. And I will say most of them seemed to come out of the mid-Missouri area. They were just good statesmen from my perspective.
You ended up moving to Kansas City and going to law school at UMKC, right?
I did. Yeah.
What was that move to Kansas City like for you, and what really brought you here?
So it was jarring to come to Kansas City. That was the first time I really experienced violence levels, you know, and the chronic violence that this city experiences. And I remember being jarred by it. I remember being, you know, jarred.
How did you encounter it on the watching the news or?
Well, I encountered it this way. I encountered it by, you know, a helicopter overhead shining a spotlight in and around my home, you know, up and down my driveway, and you know, they were looking for someone, obviously, and hearing gunshots. And, you know, I said I grew up on a farm, I'm accustomed to hearing gunshots, but not at night. We didn't hear gunshots at night. You know?
Not mysterious ones, like you knew what those gunshots were, I'm guessing.
Right. And if you didn't know, you found out, right? I mean, I did not see a lot of irresponsible gun ownership, people firing weapons into the air. I never actually saw that. As a kid,
and I bet New Year's Eve in Kansas City was a surprise.
it was another jarring evening for me. Was wow, that's how people we celebrate here. That's scary.
Within the study of the law, what really captured your interest and attention early on?
Oh, there's no doubt. It's always been victims and trying to find a way to represent them and do right by them and. And sometimes, you know, have the law catch up to them.
What do you mean by that?
I remember, you know, I got married as a young person and, still married, not that young person anymore, but, married a wonderful man. And I realized that I joined a club after getting married that where rape was, a spouse could rape their spouse, and it wasn't rape in the state of Missouri. I didn't know that at the time. Not when it impacted my decision to marry, but it did make me mad. It made me real mad. I thought, that's crazy. That was in 1990, by the way. You know, it's not that long ago, really.
Was that a cause that you took up?
Yes, it was. It was. And by 1991, that law changed.
I mean, that's a pretty incredible thing to find yourself newly in the position of that the work that you do can change your own kind of like legal standing.
Yeah, I mean, I just didn't like it. I didn't like it. It wasn't part of my experience, of course, but it just felt gross, and I knew, and it felt wrong. So I will tell you, I have had, as a prosecutor, I've had cases where I've tried them of a rape that occurred in the 1980s, some in the 1990s, where this law was in place, where one of the elements of the crime is I have to prove this woman was not married to her rapist. And jurors often look at me with their, you know, their eyebrows, you know, or their
doing
eyebrows
what I'm
are,
doing right now.
Yeah, what your eyebrows are doing right now. And, you know, I'm like, hey, this was the law then. So this is what I'm required to prove. And so, sorry, this is what I have to do. And I, you know, I have to apologize to victims ahead of time, because how insulting to say, hey, just to clear up this one point, you weren't married to that guy that I've charged with raping you, that I'm trying to get convicted today of raping you. You know, it's an offensive question, but it's an element in the law that I had to disprove marriage, so it wasn't technically legal.
You know, your sense of indignation as like a motivating force really comes through throughout this conversation, and just like a moral position about like the right thing to do. And I'm curious if you can trace that back to an origin point, or if that's just like what it is for you. You were born that way. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know how to answer that. I know, you know, my parents had certain rules, and my mom was, and still is, a very strict person. But you know, they were my parents, so they were the rule of law, right? There was no other. But I knew some of the positions that they had, like my dad's view of women. I knew I couldn't necessarily voice that out loud. But even as a little kid, I was like, my dad's not right about that, you know?
So that's just your own, you followed your own kind of internal compass on moral questions or on fairness questions?
Well, I think that's true. I think also, you know, being raised and going to school, my early years in a Catholic school environment, these Catholic nuns really taught you to think, you know, think about justice and think about your position in the world. And while there were certain pieces of history, you know, that were certainly left out of my upbringing, they did teach me to be inquisitive and to look for social justice. And when you encounter inequities, fix it.
You know, you were hired right out of the gate by Claire McCaskill. Tell me about what you did in her office when she was county prosecutor.
Well, I did what she told me to do, first off. She was the boss, and I started as an intern. And I just sort of, you know, as new positions came open, or, at, you know, at that time, the office just moved you where they thought you were better suited. I went wherever they told me to go, basically. So I do remember working for Prosecutor Bob Baird, and he called me to his office and directed me to respond to a new position the following Monday. And I remember being pretty unhappy with that decision, because I wanted to be a trial lawyer, and I thought it was time to get myself in the courtroom. And he put me in a community role instead.
Do you look back on that as something that worked for you, or do you still think, nope, I should have just gotten to trial?
No, he was right. Yeah, he was right, and I was not. That community role made me a much better trial lawyer when, you know, I started to get the experiences of trying cases, because I got to meet real Kansas Cityans that were really down on their luck, so to speak. You know, folks that lived in hotels.
Yeah, I actually read this Kansas City Star article about, at one point in your career, you know, when the demolition of the Motel Capri was ordered, and then you saw a mother and child moving out in the parking lot outside. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that was that job that Bob Baird sent me to. And I will say he probably did regret it, because what I did in the role that he sent me to was do inspections of area motels. I did it through a collaboration, so I didn't go alone. I made sure that we had all the right players, and we did surprise inspections at motels that had really extremely high call volume for police to be able to manage crime in those locations. And the Capri was one of those, which has since been destroyed. It's been demolished, but that only happened fairly recently.
Yeah.
That motel was
over on Independence Avenue.
Yes, it was a sad place, And I viewed it at first through the eyes of a young prosecutor that thought this place is evil. You know, I want to see this place shut down. And I figured all the people in it must be the same.
That they would want that too.
That they would want it too. Yes. And while we were in the process of literally closing that motel down, I saw a family with suitcases pulling them across the street. And so I ran to talk to them to see why they were where they were going. And they had just had to be expelled from the Capri too, because that's where they lived. And they had nowhere to go at that point in time. And that was a real moment as a young prosecutor learning that prosecutors' actions have real, real consequences for people, and to be much more thoughtful about the lives that you're impacting and how you're impacting them.
Tell me about the decision to run for the office you now hold. Was it a tough decision? It seems like an all-consuming job, and one with, if you don't mind my saying so, like a serious intimidation factor if you are at all susceptible to that.
I don't know what you mean.
Like, I think it would be a scary job to do.
Oh, well, I don't think of it like that. I did not pause at all when the job came open. That I knew I was qualified. I knew there was much I didn't know, and I acknowledged that too at the time. But I knew I could do it. I knew I could do it. And I got to see a lot of different people in that job. I worked for most all of them. So I could see, I had some real ideas, I thought, about how I could make it better, how
Such
I
as.
Could improve it. One, I wanted to improve what we call our discovery process. I wanted to make sure my office at that time, we were stuck in an old era. You know, I will call it the handshake era of here you go, defense lawyer, handshake. Here's this stack of documents and, I'll see you in trial next week or wherever. We continued that practice long after it no longer worked.
Why didn't it work? What didn't work about it?
Well, you have to be able to prove what you've given over. And so if you have poor discovery practices...
What does that mean, discovery practices?
Discovery is simply the case. You know, all of those documents that need to be turned over to the defense lawyer so that defense can properly represent their client. And that's the job of a prosecutor. But a prosecutor has to be smart about how that discovery process is conducted. You have to survive the test of time as well. So you have to be able to prove 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, the discovery that you did give, how did you give it in the manner that you gave it. And we did not do that well.
How did you change it?
We just put some real metrics in place. And I taught then about the new process, about how we were going to do things. There were many people very, very unhappy with me when I started that process because, you know, I mean, it's more fun to shake someone's hand and to be very informal about discovery practices. And it had been our practice.
There was a culture in place.
There was definitely a culture in place. So I got a lot of pushback on that. But I knew ultimately it was the right thing to do. And I also wanted to make sure defense and judges felt they had confidence that, you know, my office was doing our job the way we were supposed to.
Jean Peters-Baker, hang on through one more break, okay? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCOR Central Standard. Today's show is a portrait session with Jackson County Prosecutor Jean Peters-Baker. When we return, her political ambitions. We'll ask for her insights into the state of the Democratic Party in Missouri right now as well. That's next. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I'm here for just a little longer with Jean Peters Baker, the Jackson County prosecutor. Jean, there is a definite assumption that you have bigger political ambitions. I wonder where you see yourself headed long term.
I see myself headed into 2020 running for Jackson County prosecutor, and I'm committed to that, and that's what I'm going to do.
Something that you get asked a lot?
I do get asked that a lot. And I appreciate the question because one of my other roles is to find qualified candidates, to try and seek out some qualified candidates that will run for office, because it's a very hard job sometimes to put yourself out there in the public eye, raise money, so sometimes you can hold a job that pays a whole lot less than what you could earn through other means. So, but public service, I just don't think there's a better job overall than public service.
You've spent time serving as a Missouri State Rep for the 39th District?
That's right.
What was that like?
I loved that job. I actually loved that job, and I miss it. I miss it because I became, I hope, one of the good ones. When I was a young person serving tours of the Capitol building in Jefferson City and watching those politicians, I became one of them. And it just is a dynamic, awesome job. It's hard. It's very hard to be away from your family, to spend several days per week in Jefferson City and to be away from them. That's a huge commitment, but it is such a worthy cause. So whatever your politics, I'm really grateful that people are willing to go do that job.
You know, you've mentioned that when you gave tours of the Capitol, that it looked more like a frat party to you than an arena in service of the public. And in recent years, it has really become the public has become aware of what women have sometimes faced in that setting. And on top of that, while you were there, you were in a political minority. That had to be frustrating at times. And so I appreciate that you loved the job, but I'm curious about those aspects of it.
When I was there, I was an older woman as well. I had served as a prosecutor for about 15 years already. And, it depends on who the viewer is. Maybe I'm sure of myself. So that can be, however you want to look at me, that's good or that's bad, right? But I wasn't one of the prey. So I was not someone that, would be put in that kind of position. So it took me a little while to realize, oh, but my interns are, some of these legal assistants are, and that was not okay. And it doesn't matter. You shouldn't have to be a certain station in life to go serve time in Jefferson City and cross your fingers that you're not going to be a victim of constant sexual harassment.
And what about this, what it's like to work within a political minority in Jeff City?
It is what it is. There we are. And what I would remind people is that politics is forever changing. So for those who are comfortably feeling like they're in charge, be careful, because there was a time where Democrats were comfortably in charge in Jefferson City. It will come back. It's going to come back. So don't get too comfortable there.
I mean, that brings me to, with your role in the Democratic Party in Missouri, I wonder if you can shed light on what you see as the future of that party in this state, your own ambitions notwithstanding. Some say, and I hate to put it this way, that the party is kind of toast.
No, I don't think that at all. I think that politics is always in this is in an ebb and flow. And 20 years ago, Democrats ran politics for the state of Missouri. You know, if you think about eras, that's really not long ago. And it will change again. It's what we can count on. How quickly it changes, I don't have the answer about that. But I do know this, and I'm 100% confident about this. Divided government is best government. So when you have too much of a singular party running anything, you will not have great representation. That's a truth, because good government comes from compromise, and compromise only comes when people are forced to do it.
You have been pointing a finger forcefully at me through this. This is now we're getting somewhere. I want you to paint a picture as someone who has worked in the sausage making on the sausage making side of government to explain to me, like, make the case, because I know you can do that, that divided government is the best government, not based on ideas, but based on what you have seen.
So when I was in Jefferson City, and it still remains true today, that Democrats were not allowed to have bills that were debated on. You know, what is that? I mean, I'm sorry. I know I'm not supposed to cuss on your
program. You didn't. You paused.
Okay. But, you know, that's not government. You know, I mean, what are you scared? You're so scared you can't let Democrats, you know, because you run the committee and you're a Republican, you can't let a Democrat actually have a bill that gets debated. So that's just cowardice. And I would say the same would be true for Democrats if they were in charge and they simply shut down debate. One should not fear debate. Don't fear debate. So even regarding, you know, let's talk about background checks. You know, wouldn't it be nice, truly, wouldn't it be nice if in the people that we pay to go to Jefferson City from all pockets of the state of Missouri could actually talk about and debate background checks? Wouldn't that be nice? But we can't do it because one party is only in charge. That's just one issue. But what about health care? There are a lot of issues that we could get to a closer resolution on if there was more divided government, meaning there were more points of view that were allowed to have a voice at the table.
But what you so often see is a stalemate instead of that.
I think we don't even see stalemate. What I experienced when I was in Jefferson City is that when I was making good points on the House floor and the speaker saw me, unfortunately, and called on me, my mic would go dead. My mic would literally go dead. I just think how ridiculous that we can't even have debate. Let's not fear debate.
It reminds me of, you know, when you're a kid and you're playing a board game and someone's losing and they throw all the pieces off the board.
Yeah, well, yes. Well, let's have a full Monopoly game. Let's see who wins.
Our time is up. Jean Peters Baker, thanks for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
Jean Peters Baker is the Jackson County prosecutor. She's just the second woman to hold that position, and we've spent today's show hearing her story. If you missed it, we'll have it up online for you later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. And her story will appear with photographic portraits by the talented Paul Andrews. Talk to us on Twitter anytime. We're at KCURCST. Tomorrow is a food show. We'll hear about the best desserts in Kansas City from some regular food critics and a special guest critic, Anthony Perofsky of Queer Eye on Netflix. Shared his faves when he was in town last week. We'll share those with you tomorrow on Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf, Aviva Okeson-Haberman, and intern Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.